The following presentation is from North Pine Baptist Church. We trust that it will help you learn more about God and His message for the world. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.
Thank you, guys. It's good to be with you again. Tonight, I'm going to just share a little bit from my experience. I'm a missionary's kid. My dad was a pastor, but he always wanted to be a missionary, and so now he runs his own missions organization called Global Gateway Network. But he also does a lot of work in North Africa, in India, and in Southeast Asia, specifically in the country of Vietnam and Thailand. And so I was invited into that space very early on. We left America for Japan when I was in grade 9, and we were there to be church planters. My dad was a church planter, and maybe 9 months into our first, what we would have anticipated to be about a four-year stint, we were brought home because of the first Gulf War. And so I think it was about 90% of my dad's what we would call faith offerings that churches would give to missionaries to help them sustain their living in another country just disappeared. And so we had to come home and kind of got back into the rhythm of living in America. And I think it was a couple of years later when my dad was invited to go back to Japan as a Christian administrator of a high school. And so we went back, and that's where I met my wife, Ellie. Her dad was an American military officer, and so she was coming to the same Christian school that my dad was administrating. And so that kind of began my journey into missions. And when I was 18, I thought, this is what I want to give my life to. And so I joined, maybe you've heard of it, it was called Youth with a Mission. And so I joined this organization, and we went to places like the Philippines and India and Hong Kong and Macau. We worked in orphanages where children were abandoned because they were special needs, or they were girls. Where in China, that they have the two-child policy that now is gone, but back then it was quite prevalent for kids to just be left anywhere. And so I began kind of learning, and I remember one of the things that really stuck with me, and today we're going to talk a little bit about poverty, about God's heart for the poor, about the work of compassion. I know that many of you would have been here when I spoke earlier in May. Compassion is the largest Christian child discipleship organization in the world that works specifically only through the local church. In 29 different countries, we're working around the world in places of extreme poverty. And extreme poverty is kind of where the poorest of the poor live. And the picture that I got of this when I was about, I think I was 19 or 20, when I went to India for the first time. And we were in downtown Delhi, and we saw this young man who had elephantitis. And if you don't know what elephantitis is, it's a sickness that just kind of, it makes your body balloon, and it's easily treatable. And so some of the crew that were with us and were evangelizing and helping feed and bring water to people, we said to him, we'll take you to the hospital, and we will help you get the medicine to fix this. And he said to us, why would I do that? Because then I would not be able to beg. And if I am not able to beg, I am not able to make a living. And if I am not able to have a living, then I will die. And that's when I began to understand that poverty was a bit bigger than just not having medicine or not having food or not having access to education or medical care. That it was much more complex than that. And it began this lifelong journey of wanting to partner with Jesus to become all that I could become in order to share with others what it looks like to be involved with God's heart for the poor. And so for tonight, we're going to look at some statistics. We're going to look at what the Old Testament says about poverty and helping the poor. We'll look at some stuff from the New Testament, and we'll end with kind of how compassion looks to alleviate this by releasing children from poverty in Jesus' name through child sponsorship. And it's easy to think that child sponsorship is just this simple thing where I give a little bit of money every month and a child is helped, but it's so much more than that. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. But as I start, I thought it would be fun, maybe not fun, to talk a little bit about some statistics. And so I wanted to give you guys a quiz. I wanted to ask you a question. I've got a few questions here, and you can answer them, or you can just say in your mind what you think they are, and then I'll tell you the answer. But if you were to take a guess, how many people do you think live in extreme poverty today? And I will say that for about maybe 2.5 decades, the global poverty rate was decreasing at a very fast rate, and then COVID hit. And then it has ballooned back up to, in some places, 30%. But it's quite bad right now. But if you were to take a guess, I'll just give you a couple numbers. Do you think it's 691 million or 333 million? 691, it's a trick question. 691 million is the number, but 333 million of those people that live in extreme poverty are children. So these are kids that don't know where their next meal is coming from, that the World Health Organization would say they live on less than $2.11 a day American, which is roughly $3.30, $3.20 Australian dollars a day. I just got back from Kenya, which I have some little things here. I talked a little bit about this when I was here in May, but I got this in a village called Olashaiki, and it's like a cow, a little bit like Batman when I'm. But it's what the pastor and the father of my sponsor child put on my shoulders when I visited their house, and it's given to warriors, and so I felt very strong. But it has the, you know, the Maasai people, they do the shoulder dancing, right? And they jump really high. I'm not going to jump for you because I'm a white guy. But this is what something that they would wear for their ceremonial dress. But normally, they would wear something like this. You might see these when you see things about Africa. They would, you know, put them around. Then they might have a stick, right? And Donas, the younger brother of Fidelis, who was my sponsor child, he had a stick and he was out, you know, rounding up the goats. And they said to me, they said, "Oh, Ryan, have you ever milked a goat?" And I said, "No, I've never milked a goat." And they said, "Well, would you like to try?" And I knew they were going to probably pay me out, right? Like, but what they didn't know is that I have milked cows. And they didn't ask me if I had ever milked a cow. I did not tell them this. And so he went and he chased down a goat, and he got the goat and he drug it over and he started to milk it. And he was like, "It's your turn." Like, you know, he had a twinkle in his eye. And when I got down behind the goat and began to milk it, they were astonished. And then I tilted it up and I squirted him. And the whole entire family thought that that was the funniest thing they'd ever seen. This Muzungu, this white boy, coming in and squirting Fidelis with the goat milk. It was pretty funny. But this is the kind of place, right, where it's even worse than the $2.11 U.S. a day. They make about $20 a month, right? And so let's just kind of think about that in terms of what that means for us. $20, you know, it's maybe a package of mints, a thing of pasta, and maybe a couple cans of tomatoes. That's a meal that we would have just on a regular weeknight, spaghetti bolognese. We could have that 4 times for what they make in a month. And it just begins to, I think, show us that poverty is a bit more complex than just not having money, right? It's about location. It's about resources. It's about opportunities. It's about agency. It's about all these other things that go into it. How much does someone earn in extreme poverty. I probably got ahead of myself a little bit and told you the $2.11 a day. That's a crazy amount to think about, right? This idea that a person in extreme poverty only makes about $3 Australian a day, right? Or that idea of $20 a month. It's wild to think about that. In our neighborhood in Southeast Asia, which I would say Australasia, how many children are living in extreme poverty just in our neighborhood? Is it 10 million? Is it 30 million? Or is it 50 million? 50 million or more. More than 50 million. Asia ranks as the second richest continent economically, yet it's home to two-thirds of the world's poor. Right? And this is an amazing thing to think about. Right? There is so much wealth in Asia, but there is also the most poor, most poverty of children in the world. Now I think it's a good idea to maybe turn it to a little bit of good news, right? Because I think we want to move from the bad news to the good news. We want to get from where we are to where God wants us to be. So in the Compassion Program, how many local church partners run the Compassion Program? Is it 400 churches? Is it 1,000 churches, or is it 9,000 churches? It's 9,000 churches. 9,000 churches partner. Last year, when I first came to North Pine and shared, the number was 8,500. And now it's actually probably like 9,200, but 9,000 is the number that we use for our presentations, because it's just a nice round number. But the very cool thing is that churches come knocking on our door and saying, can we please be a part of the program? And our heart is to say yes to them. And so we will take every church that wants to become a part of our program, and we'll walk through them with the pre-screening, kind of this journey that says this is what it takes to go on the journey with Compassion. And so they'll learn about, they'll have someone that walks with them through partnership of what's it look like to run the program. How do we set up good systems in order to run the program well? How do we maintain child safety, which is our primary concern, is to make sure the children are known, loved, and protected. But then how do we move them then into that next space of what's it look like for this church to become self-sustaining over a journey with Compassion that could be, you know, anywhere from 15 to 25 years? We want to see churches grow in their ability to produce the program on their own without the need of a sponsor. And in fact, in Thailand, we're graduating almost 80% of the programs in Thailand, which is an amazing good news story that these churches are now able to run the program on their own. They're able to have access to the care and the education that they never had before. So it's a good news story, but this is where our kind of part becomes to take a little bit more responsibility, is that one out of every five churches is who we can say yes to because of funding. So like if we had more funding, we could say yes to more churches. It's kind of the endless cycle of there's always more work to do. There's always more opportunity. How can we make the most of every opportunity that we have? So if there's 9,000 churches that run the Compassion Program in 29 countries, how many kids do you think are registered in the program right now? Is it 500,000 kids? Is it 2.3 million kids? Or is it 3.3 million kids? It's 2.3 million. And our dream is to get to 3.3 million in the next 5 years, right? So it took us about 50 years as an organization to get to our first million children released from poverty in Jesus' name. It only took 11 years to get the second million. And so now we're at 2.3, and we have, because of our CEO, Claire, and our president of Compassion International, Jimmy Mulatto, aspirational goals that the kingdom continues to advance, the kingdom continues to go forward, that we believe that God is going to give us the ability to reach that next million in the next 5 years, and we're 300,000 closer than we've ever been before. So we're very excited. But so tonight, I want to just take us kind of on a little journey, because the world is often, right, is often consumed with bad news. It's often consumed with despair, and poverty has a way of making us feel really bad about life and feel less, and that's what it does, is it robs. Poverty robs children and communities of their voice. But I think we've gathered here to discover a different narrative, one that the Bible speaks about is love, resilience, and wisdom that can move us forward and to do the things that only God has placed in our path to do as Christians. What does it look like for us to bring relief to those in need? So together we're going to look a little bit at the Bible, explore, maybe renew our passion to lift those up in need, and to learn about the Bible's radically generous perspective on poverty and how, against all odds, we can make an impact that resounds with laughter, joy, and an unshakable hope. So what does the Bible say? What does the Old Testament say about poverty and helping the poor? Well, in the Old Testament, we find that the biblical perspective on poverty and helping the poor is rooted very firmly in the character and nature of God himself. Throughout the Old Testament, there's numerous teachings that emphasize the importance of caring for the poor and the marginalized in society as a means for building God's kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven. God has compassion for the poor. This is what I spoke about when I talked about this feeling that God's deep concern for the poor, but his desire for justice and mercy to also prevail. Proverbs 14:31 says, "Whoever oppresses the poor shows contempt for their maker, but whoever is kind to the needy honors God." This verse illustrates that showing kindness and generosity to the poor is an act of honoring God himself. It's also a call of justice and righteousness. The Old Testament repeatedly calls upon God's people to seek justice and righteousness. Isaiah 1:17 says, "Learn to do right, seek justice, defend the oppressed, take up the cause of the fatherless, and plead the case of the widow." This verse highlights the responsibility of believers to correct oppression and defend the rights of the vulnerable, including the poor. In the Old Testament, God establishes various provisions to ensure the welfare of the poor. For example, the gleaning laws in Leviticus 19 command landowners to leave portions of their crops for the poor to gather. These were called the different corners of the field. They would have a circle that would, most of that would be taken, but then they would leave the corners to those who had nothing. This demonstrates God's concern for the providing for those in need. Not only did God make account for sharing these provisions that of those who had many, but also the Old Testament encourages us to share our resources and care for those who lack. Proverbs 22, verse 9 says, "The generous will themselves be blessed, for they share their food with the poor." This verse teaches the value of generosity and selflessness, promoting a spirit of compassion towards those experiencing poverty. There's many blessings for generosity. In the Old Testament, there's also this emphasis that blessing will come to those who are generous to the poor. Proverbs 19, verse 17 says, "Whoever is kind to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will reward them for what they have done." This is an assurance that believers, when they extend kindness and assistance to the poor, they're acting in partnership with God, who promises to bless them. You'll also find in the Old Testament the ability and the need to care for the widows and orphans. Consistently, you'll see this highlight of our responsibility to care for these that are vulnerable among us. James, as we know in the New Testament, says he echoes this sentiment by saying that religion God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after the orphans and the widows in their distress. This demonstrates God's continuous concern for the marginalized throughout the Bible. So we move from this idea in the Old Testament of those who have are asked to give to those who don't. That those who have much are asked to set aside some of what they have in order for those who don't have anything to have something. And this idea, it continues on in the New Testament. Through Jesus' lived example, he himself demonstrates compassion for the poor and the marginalized. He spent much of his ministry reaching out to the poor, healing the sick, and feeding the hungry. In Luke chapter 4, Jesus begins his ministry by echoing the words of the prophet Isaiah, where he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor." His life and teachings serve as a model for us to follow. I find it interesting that Jesus never turned anyone away. Right? He had the ability to meet the needs of everyone that came to him. I know that we're not the same in that same way that Jesus was able to do things that we're not able to do, but I think that he shows us something that then you see the disciples beginning to work out is how can we actually take what we have and make sure that it's used for the biggest benefit of those who have none, right? Even in the beginning of Acts, after Jesus ascended to the right hand of the Father, right? We have this, everything is going great, right? The Spirit has come. They're prophesying. They're speaking in ways that they've never spoken before. Peter is giving an amazing presentation. Many are coming to the knowledge of Jesus. They're being baptized. Things are going great. And then where does it all go wrong, right? It's the widows and the orphans and those who don't have anything. Their needs are no longer being met. And this is when the early church kind of has its first disagreement. How are we going to take care of those who cannot take care of themselves? And so we see this happening in Acts chapter 6 and Acts chapter 7. This idea of what does it look like for us to come together as a church to take the little that we have and to bestow it on those who don't have anything and see God multiply it. And this is the heartbeat of the New Testament, is to meet the needs with what we have, to give God what we have and see him meet these needs in a way that's miraculous. Jesus lives this example. The New Testament encourages believers to be radically generous and selfless. In Acts 20, the Apostle Paul quotes Jesus saying, "It's more blessed to give than to receive." This perspective challenges the common mindset of accumulating wealth and promotes sacrificial giving to alleviate the needs of the poor. The early church's care for the poor, right? It begins in Acts chapter 2, before we get to 6 and 7, is that all the believers were together and they had everything in common. And they would sell property. They would give possessions to anyone who had need. This communal sharing exemplifies the Christian commitment of helping in the poor. I love in Mark chapter 12, Jesus observes a poor widow giving two small coins as an offering in the temple. He praises her act, highlighting her sacrificial giving in contrast to the wealthy who gave out of their abundance. I saw that when I came in, you had the pot from Sunday, right? Where this idea that it was for show, that they would give out of their abundance. But the widow is giving, as Jesus said, all she had to live on. This account teaches that even the smallest acts of generosity from those in poverty hold great value in the eyes of God. We also see in the New Testament loving through practical action. Sometimes money is not the thing that we have to give. Jesus emphasized caring for the poor in the vulnerable and practical but loving ways, and how doing so has eternal impact. He states that acts of compassion toward the hungry, the thirsty, the stranger, the naked, the sick, the imprisoned, are really acts of compassion towards him. When we serve the poor, we serve Jesus himself. This passage highlights the eternal importance of responding to poverty and the responsibility we bear as followers of Christ. When I spoke, I shared the story of Jesus feeding the 4,000. And I talked about how we have to be able to see the need, but then it's more than just seeing the need, it's feeling the need. But then it's more than just feeling the need, it's meeting the need, right? And this is kind of a precursor to maybe the greatest story that Jesus ever told, which was that of the Good Samaritan, right? And you see the same kinds of things happening in this story as those points from the feeding the 5,000. You have to see the need, but then you have to choose to engage it, right? Like, the ones who should have engaged were the ones who walked to the other side of the road and carried on. And Jesus, he does this amazing thing, right? It's this interplay between him and one of the young rulers of the law, right? He asks him, you know, what must I do to inherit eternal life? That's where this story comes from, right? And Jesus tells him, this is all the things you got to do, and this guy knows it, and it's kind of like he's testing Jesus, and he wants Jesus to know how smart he is. Have you ever been in a conversation where somebody wants you to know how smart they are? And that's kind of this guy with Jesus. And Jesus is like, look, you're making it very complex, but it's actually a little bit more simple than that. And so they're in this exchange, and we get to this question of, okay, then who's my neighbor? And Jesus does this amazing thing as he turns this paradigm upside down of the very person that was supposed to be the hero of the story becomes the villain, right? The one who taught the law, the Levite, the Pharisee, the ruler, this Jesus is basically making the guy who's asked the question the villain of the story. And the hero of the story is someone that's reviled. But he's the one that doesn't just see, he's the one that engages, right? And then he does this amazing thing that I think we don't really spend a lot of time on, and I hope that you'll catch it tonight, is he bandages his wounds and he puts him on his own donkey or burro or whatever it is, and he takes him to an innkeeper, and then he gives the innkeeper some money. And he says, take care of him, and if it's not enough, when I come back, I'll give you more. And I wonder if maybe in this story, we're the innkeeper. What gift has God given us to take care of the poor? It's just two coins. It's just a couple of silver coins. But he gives it to the innkeeper. He asks the innkeeper to steward this money for this person. And I wonder if maybe this is the thing that Jesus is asking us is, what has he given you to steward for the poor, for the one that's been beaten, for the one that's been broken, for the one that should not have been in the situation that it was, but it is, because life is so unfair and absurd sometimes. It's not always the way that we want it to be. And that's kind of the message of poverty, isn't it? That nobody chooses poverty. No one chooses to be born in a place that has no food, has no access to clean water, has no access to medical care. Why did I have the blessing that I was given? Because I was born in a place that's amazing. And then I think, how did I escape that place that's so amazing and come to an even better place in Australia? Right? Like, and boy, I hope my mom and dad aren't listening to this tonight. Right? But like, there's this idea, right, in Australia that we're so much better, and there's so much truth to that. That where we live is so good. Where we live is so amazing. Do we think about eternity in the light that where we live is maybe better? It's easy for us to think that this is the best it's ever going to be. How often do we think about eternity? Coming back from Kenya, I've had this conversation with myself and with God over and over again. What does it look like for me to be the steward of the little that I have in order to take care of those who have nothing? Because everything that I've been given is a gift from God. That the two coins that the Samaritan gave to the innkeeper was a gift to take care of someone else. But it's easy for me to think about, oh, I need to hold on to what I have to take care of my own. And that's not untrue. I think there's some wisdom in making sure that we're taking care of our families and not doing things that are unwise. No one would ask you to do that. But I think maybe the scriptures would ask us to have a deeper conversation with ourselves around what is the responsibility of someone who lives in the way of Jesus, who is a Christ follower, who believes in the redemption of all things, to be a part of the kingdom as it expands. The parable of the Good Samaritan asks us some very deep questions. And it's a lesson that I hope will never leave me, that I want to continue to wrestle with that. What does it look like for me to find myself in that story? Because I know sometimes I'm the one who needs the help. Sometimes I'm the one who chooses to engage in help. And sometimes I'm the innkeeper who has been gifted something in order to take care of others. How should Bible-believing Christians think about poverty and helping the poor today? I think that we as followers of Jesus should approach poverty and helping the poor with a holistic and compassionate mindset, guided by the principles and teachings of what we've just read from the scriptures in the Bible. I think there's some key aspects that we have to consider, though. And first and foremost, we have to understand that poverty is complex. We have to recognize that poverty is a multifaceted issue with many causes. It's not only material lack, but it's also social lack, emotional lack, and spiritual lack. I think we should strive to understand that the root causes of poverty, such as inequality, injustice, and lack of opportunities, we have to know what these are in order to address them effectively. And so this is why I'm really, really grateful for the way that Compassion is church-driven. It works only in local churches. Local churches that are already in their community, already loving and evangelizing the people in their community, known and loved by their community. One of the tests that is done is kind of the walk around the community when you're becoming a Compassion program. The project facilitator will walk around town with the pastor of the church. And if nobody knows that pastor, that's a red flag. But most of the time, anytime I've walked through a local community with a pastor of the church, he knows everybody by name. He's beloved. The kids, the parents, the people who don't come to his church know them and appreciate and respect them. Right? We have to understand that there's lots of things at play. We have to really resource those people who are best positioned to meet the needs of their community. We have to choose compassion and empathy, cultivating a heart of compassion and empathy towards those experiencing poverty. Sometimes this is hard for us to do because we feel like you just need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You need to work harder. You need to get a job. These are all things I've heard myself tell my son, right? Like, these are all real things that we've felt. But Jesus asks us to cultivate a heart of compassion and empathy towards those experiencing poverty. We don't know what the complex issue behind their poverty is. We should actively seek to understand their struggles, listen to their stories, and treat them with dignity and respect. Viewing the poor through the lens of Christ's love inspires genuine care and desire to alleviate their suffering. Moving beyond a passive concern, we then can engage personally in helping the poor. This could be volunteering at local charities, organizations that address poverty in our own communities, or advocating for policies that promote justice, supporting a global charity, or getting involved in community development initiatives. Christians can use their skills, resources, and influence to care for the poor. I also love that as a part of the Compassion program, we think that the relationship that you're building with a sponsor child is more powerful than poverty. This idea that we can write to a child and tell them, you're loved, that somebody in another country is praying for you, that we believe in you, that we want the best for you, that we can speak words of affirmation in scripture over them, is just undeniably impressive in their little hearts. I've seen how they've taken the letters and kept them for years. I had a picture in my presentation that I unfortunately was not able to show of a young man named Jumar. He is maybe in his mid-30s now, and he still has the first letter that he ever received when he became a sponsor child in the Philippines. And he showed it to us. He pulled it out of his Bible and showed it to us. It was an amazing, amazing thing that his sponsor would continue to write to him, even those 24 years later, continuing to encourage him. I think we need to recognize how powerful collaboration and partnerships can be in addressing poverty. By joining forces with like-minded individuals and churches, organizations, and government entities, Christians can effectively and collectively see lasting change. And together we can share our resources and expertise to tackle poverty comprehensively. We want to see and empower sustainable solutions. We want to seek to empower individuals and communities in their journey out of poverty instead of providing temporary relief and focus on sustainable solutions that address the underlying causes of poverty. A lot of times, these are things that they would never have known otherwise. And let me give you an example of this. In September, I went to a place called Barastagi, which is on the island of North Sumatra. It's up in the mountains between two volcanoes. And we had been visiting churches in Medan, this very, very populous kind of metro area where there's tons of city poverty. And so we'd been visiting churches and seeing what it was like in Medan. It was very hot, and it was very sticky and very just dirty. And so then we went to this church that was up in the mountains, about 4 hours outside of Medan. And it was cool. It was beautiful. They were farmers. It was just a different kind of rural regional poverty. But one of the things that they were doing was Compassion and the local church had bought a proofing machine and a commercial oven for this church to open up a business of a bakery. And so the bakery had two adults working for it, and then the rest of the employees were teenagers. Half of them were from the Compassion program, and half of them were from the local Muslim community. So not only was it an opportunity to provide kids with skills, understanding how to run a business, understanding how to bake bread on scale, and then deliver the bread to the bakeries, and to know how much to make and how much to order. It was just quite an enterprise that we began to see that not only was it a business venture, but it was also an evangelism venture, where these families of these Muslim kids were intermingling and mixing with Christian kids in a business way, and it was just a beautiful thing. I went to another church in Kenya in a place called Machakos, where they had a church had partnered with Compassion to buy egg incubators. So they had a 500 egg incubator and a 1,000 egg incubator. And they would fill these incubators with eggs, and then they would hatch these chickens, and then they would give them to the Compassion families, and then they would have chickens that then they could eat and they could raise. They would now make eggs. And it began to see the community shift through creating generational wealth through chickens. Another place we went, Compassion would buy a goat for a family. Maybe you've seen in our Christmas appeals, we have these things called Gifts of Compassion, where you can buy a goat. I think the goat is $45, maybe $70. I don't remember. But it's something that's not outrageous. But one goat can change a family's life. I met this girl, her name's Naishura. She's 14 years old. Her dream is to be in the Olympics as a runner. And she actually, just before we got there, the weekend before, had won a regional event for running. Regional, like in her half of the state. So like she is quite a fast runner for a 14-year-old. But her job is to take care of the goat. And so she takes care of the goat. The goat lives so close to her, but this goat has changed their family's fortune, because not only now the goat had a baby, right? They were able to sell the baby, but the mom still makes the milk. They're able to milk the goat. She has babies every certain amount of months, and they're able to either sell a goat or keep one to eat, right? It becomes this cycle of seeing a family begin to flourish that wasn't able to flourish before. We sat outside their home. The roof of the house was maybe an inch taller than me. I am not a tall guy, right? And so we had this guy, Rob, who was a policeman, and he was probably 6'4". He had to duck down to get into their house. Their house was maybe 5 meters by 3 meters. 9 of them lived in this house. But the church saw their need and banded together and was able to build them a new house, which was 2 bedrooms. And it was made out of steel and wood and tin instead of the mud and the dung that they used to construct the buildings in this area of Kenya. It was an amazing thing. the bakery, the egg incubator. We went to another place where, have you ever heard of black soldier farming? Neither had we. It was the most amazing thing. We went into this greenhouse, and there were some metal shelves along the wall with some plastic bins that were just the stinkiest thing that I had ever seen. And we were like, what on earth are you growing? And so then we went over, and a young man who was 17, he runs the whole project. He lifts up the plastic over one of these bins, and it's just teeming with larvae. These larvae are called black soldiers. And what they do is the flies come and lay the eggs. Then the eggs incubate and they grow, and then they move them into a new thing where they fill it with this kind of food that they eat that smells very bad. And then the larvae get to a certain age, which is maybe a few weeks old, which means they're big enough to then take to another rack, and they pour hot water over them, and it kills them. And then they dry them out over another 3 weeks, and then that becomes chicken feed, because the chicken feed, they don't have money to buy fertilizer or enriched chicken feed. They don't actually have chicken feed, so now they use these dried larvae to give protein to the chickens, so the chickens get big enough to eat and to have good eggs and to sell. It was amazing to see just the ingenuity of these young people farming larvae in order to feed to the chickens and the different animals as a protein source so that they would be healthy, so then they could have healthy things. Yeah, it was an amazing thing. Empowerment and sustainable solutions. You see, Compassion is interested in releasing kids from poverty in Jesus' name, which means skills. It means education. It means mentorship. It means showing them that someone will walk alongside them in these journeys as they learn and grow and become the best version that God designed and redeemed them to be. Plus, they're introduced to Jesus. They're mentored by a disciple maker. They have this relationship and personal connection with a mentor. There's 25 kids per mentor in each of these places. Each church has about anywhere from 150 to 250 kids. Maybe in some cases, if it's a large church, 300 kids. But then that comes down to like a small group leader and a mentor that walks with them, a caregiver that visits them in their home, that mentors them on a weekly basis, that meets them on a Saturday and teaches them the Bible, as well as helps them with their schoolwork and builds these lasting relationships that become guidance and a listening ear. This is an amazing opportunity that people have to build trust and offer this holistic support. So how does child sponsorship fit in with all of this? How should we as Christians approach child sponsorship in today's day and age? I think that we should approach this kind of opportunity with a heart of love and a heart that is yearning to see kids released from poverty, committed to making a lasting difference for a child in need. And there's some key principles I think that it's important to consider when we talk about sponsorship. We should do research and due diligence. We should thoroughly research organizations like Compassion to see if our program aligns with your values, and do we operate with transparency and accountability. I think we should look for organizations that prioritize holistic development, that seek to meet physical needs, that provide programs that provide access to education, healthcare, and nutritional support, as well as spiritual guidance. Comprehensive care empowers children to break free from the cycle of poverty and develop their full potential. And not only that, we should look at long-term commitments. Child sponsorship is not a short-term endeavor, but a long-term commitment. We should choose programs that allow for ongoing support and connection with a child over an extended period. So how our organization works is there's something called the survival program, right? So a mother will come to the church who is pregnant and will say, I need help. And so in the survival program, Compassion will walk alongside a small group of maybe 15 to 30 young moms who are pregnant. And they'll walk with them through that pregnancy, through when the baby is born until the baby is a year old. That's funded through something called the survival program. So different individual supporters, churches, organizations, businesses will fund these survival programs that are usually about a year and a half long. So 9 months, and then maybe it's a year and a half. I think it's exactly. Maybe it goes from 4 months pregnancy to 1 year old. And so then when the child finishes up that survival program, they're then entered into the compassion program. But it's a home-based program. So the caregiver comes to the home instead of having to bring them to the church for the first couple of years that they're alive. So they come and make sure that the home is a safe place. They come and they provide care and support and spiritual guidance for the mom as they're journeying this new and somewhat tumultuous time of being a new mom. And then when the child hits about 4 or 5, they will come and be a part of the center-based program. So about 4 or 5, till when they graduate the program, which depending on the country, could be 18, could be 20, could be in some Western African countries, 22, which has been extended because of COVID. There were a couple years where kids weren't able to get schooling very consistently, and so we've extended the program for them a couple of years out. But in the past, Compassion had something called the Leadership Development Program, which was kind of those students who were the cream of the crop, that other funds would help set them through college and get them support and mentorship. But we wanted to kind of cast a wider net for our graduates, right? Those ones who were finishing up high school and maybe going into university, or maybe they weren't going to go into university but wanted to do some kind of technical training, or maybe they wanted to go into hospitality, or maybe they wanted to do something a little bit different that there wasn't maybe a university degree for. So Compassion around the world began to find these different programs that would allow for kids to move into these things that maybe were technical programs. Maybe they were secondary things like becoming a mechanic or maybe becoming a nurse, which there weren't always university degrees for that. And so that began the journey of helping kids get through their high school journey and then deciding what was God's plan for their life, right? So we began asking this question when they turned 12 or 13. What's God's plan for your life? Have you ever had a conversation with God about what you think he wants to do or wants you to be in your journey? And then they would begin to kind of go through that mentorship through ending high school, and they would find people. Like, I got to meet Sebastian, who's 19, and he just finished his first year of seminary. He wanted to become a pastor. And so when he did God's, my plan for tomorrow, which is that God's journey for your life kind of mentorship journey, they found him a pastor that walked with him through that journey to mentor him in becoming a pastor. And so that's the idea that we would have a long-term commitment, that we would give personal support and encouragement, but that we would also be sensitive to each of these cultures that we work in, that we would provide them with the necessary means to do the thing that God's put on their heart, to respect and value where they come from. I think it was Wes Stafford, who was our previous Compassion International president before Jimmy, who tells when graduates would leave the program, he would always say to them, never forget where you came from. Never forget where you came from. And more often than not, you will find that alumni back in the church where they were a part of the program. My friend Richmond Wandera, who I shared with a little bit about his journey, he joined the program when he was 6 after his father was murdered. And now he pastors the church that he became a compassion child in. And in February, he opened the university in Kampala that is teaching lawyers and doctors and pastors. It's just an amazing story of God's faithfulness and God's goodness to see that God would call him into this place where he was at his lowest. But, right? Wes said to him, don't forget where you came from. And God began building this journey. And this journey was only able to be a part of this story because of a child sponsorship program, because of a 15-year-old girl deciding to sponsor a 6-year-old boy in Uganda, Africa. It's an amazing thing. It's an amazing story. One person can change a life. I think for us personally, it offers a pathway of growth and transformation that we can recognize that, that sponsorship is not just about transforming the life of a sponsor child, but about our own personal growth. And as we engage in child sponsorship, we might develop a deeper understanding of global poverty, how to grow in empathy and compassion, and experience the joy of making a positive impact in someone's life. These are opportunities for us to become more like Jesus. As I said earlier, what does it look like for us to steward what we have been given? What does it look like for us to go on the journey to become more like Jesus? What are the loaves and fishes that are in our basket that Jesus asks us, will we give them to the multitudes to see him take them, to bless them, and to do a miracle with them? That's the journey of understanding God's heart for the poor, that perhaps we're in the place of being asked something of Jesus. What will we do? What will we do? Maybe it's loaves and fish. Maybe it's our bread and eggs or our mints and our pasta. But what could God do with the little that we have to make way for those who have nothing? Does anybody have any questions?
Thanks for joining us for this presentation from North Pine Baptist Church. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.